Have you ever wondered why you're likely to live twice as long as your ancestors did just a few generations ago? In 1800, the average human could expect to live only 35 years. Today, that number has doubled to 70, giving each of us an extra life of about 20,000 days. This remarkable achievement represents humanity's greatest triumph, yet most of us take it for granted. Steven Johnson's Extra Life reveals this extraordinary story through a gripping narrative that weaves together science, social activism, and human ingenuity. The book has garnered praise from Bill Gates, who called it one of the most inspiring books I've ever read, while the New York Times described it as a remarkable achievement that transforms our understanding of human history. What makes this exploration particularly fascinating is how it challenges conventional wisdom about medical progress, showing that many life-saving innovations came not from brilliant lone geniuses, but from networks of unlikely collaborators, including bureaucrats, activists, and even ordinary citizens who refused to accept that early death was inevitable. For most of human history, life expectancy hovered around 35 years, a long ceiling that persisted from Paleolithic times through the 17th century. This sobering reality meant that approximately one-third of children died before adulthood, regardless of whether they lived in hunter-gatherer societies or sophisticated civilizations. When Harvard sociology student Nancy Howell traveled to the Kalahari Desert in 1967 to study the Kung hunter-gatherers, she discovered their life expectancy was about 30-35 years, remarkably similar to what British haberdasher John Grant had calculated for London residents 3 centuries earlier in 1662. Grant's revolutionary analysis of London's bills of mortality represented the birth of both demography and actuarial science. Despite lacking formal training, he systematically compiled years of death records, calculating that 36% of Londoners died before age 6, and fewer than 6% reached their 60s. His innovation was transforming raw death counts into meaningful probabilities, allowing authorities to prioritize public health threats. By estimating London's population at 384,000, remarkably close to modern historians' estimate of 400,000, he established the crucial denominator needed for demographic analysis and created the first life table showing mortality distribution. This ceiling finally began to crack around 1750, when British aristocrats' life expectancy started steadily increasing, reaching mid-40s by the 1770s, 50 by 1800, and approaching 60 by mid-Victorian times. By the second half of the 19th century, this pattern spread beyond aristocrats to ordinary Europeans and North Americans. Yet this great escape, as Nobel laureate Angus Deaton called it, created tragic gradients between industrialized nations and the developing world, where life expectancies sometimes dropped below 30 years due to exploitation and lack of public health institutions. Counterintuitively, medicine wasn't responsible for extending lives during this period. It was likely shortening them. King George III's treatment in 1788 illustrates this perfectly. His physicians prescribed arsenic compounds that modern analysis shows reached 17 times higher than poisoning thresholds. Similarly, George Washington's final hours involved 5 bloodlettings, removing 60% of his blood, along with mercury compounds and various poultices that hastened his death. This heroic medicine era persisted even to WI1, when bloodletting was still advocated for influenza. Thomas McCohen's landmark research definitively showed that population growth stemmed not from increased fertility, but from decreased mortality. Examining historical data, he discovered people stopped dying of diseases like tuberculosis before effective medical treatments existed. Rather than crediting doctors, McCohen argued improved living standards and better nutrition were responsible, a view most historians now accept. The first intervention to meaningfully improve life expectancy didn't even originate in the West. Smallpox devastated humanity since ancient Egyptian times, accounting for over 15% of all deaths in some European cities between 1650-1750. Children were especially vulnerable, with 90% of smallpox deaths occurring in children under 10. The virus dramatically shaped world history, decimating indigenous populations during European colonization and repeatedly altering European succession by killing monarchs and heirs. The first significant breakthrough in extending human life came from variolation, deliberately exposing healthy people to milder forms of smallpox to create immunity. This technique likely originated in Asia centuries before reaching Europe, with Chinese, Indian, and Persian practitioners using it by the 1600s. Though they lacked modern immunological understanding, they recognized that exposure to a lesser form of the disease created resistance, the same principle behind today's cutting-edge immunotherapies. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu introduced variolation to Britain after observing the practice in Turkey, where her son became the first British citizen to be inoculated. Though variolation carried a 2% mortality risk, Montagu recognized this was far better than the 25% childhood mortality rate of the era. Her advocacy led to trials on prisoners and eventually the inoculation of royal children, creating a tipping point that helped spread the practice through British society. The conventional narrative celebrates Edward Jenner as the heroic scientist who single-handedly developed vaccination in 1796 after observing that milkmaids exposed to cowpox seemed immune to smallpox. But this genius narrative obscures the complex network that made his breakthrough possible. Jenner himself had been inoculated as a child and regularly performed variolations as a doctor. His innovation, using cowpox instead of smallpox, built upon centuries of pre-Enlightenment healing practices transmitted to Britain largely through Mary Montagu's influence. This history reveals that medical progress depends not just on scientific discovery, but on crucial social roles within innovation networks. Beyond scientists and physicians, activists, reformers, and evangelists are essential for transforming breakthroughs into widespread practice. Thomas Jefferson demonstrated this by conducting experimental vaccine trials on approximately 200 people, including his own family members, while serving as president. Literary giant Charles Dickens emerged as vaccination's most influential advocate, publishing dozens of pro-vaccination essays and lionizing Jenner in his popular magazine. The smallpox eradication campaign stands as one of humanity's greatest achievements, initiated by Soviet Health Minister Viktor Zhdanov's 1958 speech quoting Jefferson's letter to Jenner. Despite Cold War tensions, the U.S. and USSR collaborated on this monumental effort. Jefferson had dreamed of removing smallpox from the catalog of evils, but global eradication required tools unavailable in his time. The WHO's institutional framework, microbiological understanding that smallpox had no natural reservoir outside humans, technical innovations like the bifurcated needle, and William Foges' revolutionary ring vaccination strategy. The last naturally occurring case infected Rahima Banu Begum in Bangladesh in 1975, with official eradication declared in 1980. While vaccination had extended life expectancy for the wealthy by nearly 30 years, the poor saw no improvements. Mortality rates even declined in industrial areas during the early 19th century. Despite technological advances, overall life expectancy in the United States actually dropped 13 years between 1800 and 1850. This paradox of declining health amid industrial progress became the central question driving the emerging field of epidemiology. William Farr transformed public health through his work at England's General Register Office, where he expanded mortality reporting to include cause of death, occupation, and age. "Diseases are more easily prevented than cured," he wrote, "and the first step to their prevention is the discovery of their exciting causes." Farr created systematic classification schemes for causes of death and helped establish England's first proper census in 1841. His most significant innovation was improving life tables that broke down mortality rates by age group, revealing how density determined destiny. In Liverpool, half of all children died before age 15, with average life expectancy just 25 years. Meanwhile, rural populations were breaking through the historic ceiling of 35 years, reaching nearly 50. The September 1854 removal of the Broad Street pump handle marks a crucial turning point in London's battle against cholera. Dr. John Snow, who had argued for years that cholera was waterborne rather than airborne, investigated a devastating outbreak in Soho by mapping deaths across the neighborhood. His famous map revealed a pattern clustered around a specific water pump. Snow wasn't a lone genius. He relied heavily on Farr's pioneering data collection techniques and worked with local vicar Henry Whitehead, who initially tried to disprove Snow's theory before becoming convinced. Whitehead discovered patient zero, baby Lewis at 40 Broad Street, whose waste had contaminated the well through a decaying brick wall shared with a cesspool. To solve London's cholera problem permanently required separating waste systems from water supplies through Joseph Basil Jett's remarkable engineering achievement, London's sewer system. Using 300 million bricks across 82 miles of sewer lines, including massive interception lines along the Thames, the project was functional after just 6 years, effectively ending cholera's threat to London. At century's end, W.E.B. Du Bois pioneered social epidemiology through his groundbreaking study of Philadelphia's Seventh Ward. Using sophisticated data visualization techniques, Du Bois mapped the neighborhood with color coding that revealed distinct social classes within the African-American community. More crucially, he documented shocking health disparities. Black Philadelphians were dying at rates 5% higher than whites, with childhood mortality twice as high. Du Bois' genius lay in connecting these statistics to environmental factors shaped by systemic racism. His exhaustive survey revealed that only 13.7% of black families had access to bathrooms, many apartments housed four or more people per room, and economic discrimination forced African Americans to live in the city's most unsanitary areas. This revolutionary approach, connecting health outcomes to social structures, was half a century ahead of its time. In May 1858, Brooklyn journalist Frank Leslie published a scathing exposé denouncing what he called the wholesale slaughter of the innocents. His target wasn't gangsters or drug dealers, but milkmen, whose product had become one of the deadliest killers of urban children. By the 1840s, over half of all deaths in New York were infants and young children, with contaminated milk being a primary culprit. The problem stemmed from a perfect storm of urbanization and industrialization. As Manhattan's farmland disappeared, dairy producers partnered with distilleries to feed cows swill or mash, waste products from whiskey production. Thousands of cows were crammed into urban stalls, tied in place their entire lives, fed boiling slop that caused ulcerated sores and made their teeth and tails fall off. This cruel arrangement produced cheap milk that dairy sellers adulterated with chalk, flour, and eggs to disguise its bluish color before marketing it as pure country milk. Though Louis Pasteur discovered in 1865 that heating wine to 130 degrees Fahrenheit prevented spoilage without affecting flavor, pasteurization didn't become standard practice in the American milk industry until 1915, a full 50 years later. This lag occurred because progress requires more than scientific discovery. It demands crusading journalism, activism, and politics. Science alone cannot improve the world. You also need struggle. The battle for safe milk illustrates these social interventions perfectly. Robert Milham Hartley published a damning 350-page investigation in the 1840s documenting the horrific conditions at slop dairies, but failed to sway opinion. It took Frank Leslie's illustrated exposé 15 years later, complete with shocking Thomas Nast drawings of diseased cows, to finally provoke reform. By 1862, legislation ended the swill milk era. Though Leslie's campaign eliminated swill milk, serious health risks remained. Refrigeration emerged as a critical technology, allowing milk to be stored in temperature-controlled environments, greatly reducing spoilage. But refrigeration alone couldn't eliminate contaminated milk. Pasteurization offered another solution, though consumers initially rejected it as producing less flavorful, less nutritious milk. The turning point came through Nathan Strauss, a department store owner who lost 2 children to disease. Starting in 1892, he created milk laboratories and opened milk depots selling pasteurized milk below cost in poor neighborhoods. Through persistent advocacy that attracted President Roosevelt's attention, Strauss helped make pasteurized milk mandatory in Chicago by 1909, New York by 1914, and most major American cities by the 1920s. While pasteurization transformed milk safety, another chemical breakthrough was simultaneously protecting drinking water. Dr. John Leal daringly added chlorine to Jersey City's public reservoirs, an action so controversial he nearly went to prison. But his intervention proved life-saving on an enormous scale. Between 1900 and 1930, infant mortality rates in the United States plummeted by 62%. Harvard researchers determined that filtration techniques like chlorination were responsible for more than 2/3 of this dramatic improvement. The Western declines in infant mortality took another half century to reach the developing world. During the 1971 Bangladesh Liberation War, physician Dilip Mahalanobis faced overwhelming cholera outbreaks in refugee camps. Finding traditional IV treatments impossible with just 2 staff members, he turned to oral rehydration therapy, ORT, a simple solution of water, sugar, and salt. The results were astonishing. Mortality rates dropped from 30% to 3%. ORT is now recognized as potentially the most important medical advance of the 20th century. While cholera killed 50 million in the 19th century, today it claims fewer than 50,000 lives annually, despite a tenfold increase in global population. At the dawn of the 20th century, when electricity illuminated cities and radio signals crossed continents, respected pharmaceutical companies like Parke Davis and Company still sold dangerous concoctions containing arsenic, mercury, and cocaine. Personal medical interventions likely had no net positive effect on human life expectancy until 1950. The 1889 Merck Manual recommended 100 different treatments for bronchitis, none of which actually worked. One critical factor behind medicine's delayed development was the complete lack of regulation. The S.E. Massengill Company's deadly mistake began when they sought to create a child-friendly version of sulfa drugs. Their chief chemist, Harold Watkins, dissolved sulfanilamide in diethylene glycol, a close relative of antifreeze, added raspberry flavoring, and rushed 240 gallons to market as a strep throat treatment for children. Within weeks, deaths from kidney failure were reported in Tulsa. Despite frantic efforts to recover the product, 71 adults and 34 children died. When Agriculture Secretary Henry Wallace testified before Congress, he revealed a shocking truth. Before the elixir was put on the market, it was tested for flavor, but not for its effect on human life. The FDA had confirmed it tasted like raspberries as advertised, but never investigated whether it caused kidney failure. This tragedy exposed systemic market and regulatory failures. Pharmaceutical companies had no legal incentive to create effective medicines. The deaths triggered reform, and in 1938, Roosevelt signed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, finally empowering the FDA to investigate drug safety. Decades later, FDA reviewer Francis Oldham Kelsey received an application for thalidomide, a sedative and morning sickness treatment already approved in over 40 countries. When she discovered reports of nerve damage in British medical journals, she grew concerned about potential effects on fetuses. Her instincts proved tragically correct. German obstetricians had already begun reporting unusual surges in severe birth defects. By fall 1961, European authorities linked thalidomide to over 10,000 cases of focomelia worldwide. Thanks to Kelsey's scrutiny, only a handful of cases occurred in America. The thalidomide scandal led to the 1962 Kefauver-Harris drug amendments, which required pharmaceutical companies to prove not just safety, but efficacy. they now had to demonstrate their drugs actually worked. This demand was only possible because a new scientific methodology had emerged, the Randomized Controlled Double-Blind Trial, RCT. This methodology emerged from several intellectual streams, including James Lind's proto-RCT on sailors with scurvy in 1747, statistician R.A. Fisher's randomization techniques for agricultural studies in the 1930s, and epidemiologist Austin Bradford Hill's adaptation of these methods for medicine. Hill and his colleague Richard Dahl used these techniques to investigate the alarming 15-fold increase in lung cancer deaths since 1922. Their studies established a clear relationship between smoking and lung cancer, though the medical establishment initially dismissed their findings. A decade later, the U.S. Surgeon General's landmark report officially declared cigarettes a health hazard, leading to warning labels, advertising restrictions, and taxes. Smoking rates in the U.K. have since fallen from over 50% to just 16%, with quitting before age 35 now estimated to extend life expectancy by 9 years. The discovery of antibacteria revolutionized medicine by finally giving humans a weapon against bacterial infections that had plagued civilization for millennia. While Alexander Fleming's accidental discovery of penicillin in 1928 is legendary, the true story involves an international network of scientists who transformed his observation into a life-saving medication. From Egyptian mummies showing spinal tuberculosis to Civil War soldiers dying from sepsis, bacterial infections had been humanity's nemesis for millennia. Tuberculosis alone caused a quarter of all 19th century deaths, and infections from simple cuts or medical procedures were major killers well into the 20th century. Fleming's discovery languished until World War II created urgent demand for infection treatments. The story of Nazi official Reinhard Heydrich illustrates the stakes perfectly, surviving an assassination attempt only to die from bacterial infection in his wounds, just as Allied scientists were finally producing stable penicillin in meaningful quantities. For penicillin to become a miracle drug, 3 crucial developments were needed: proving it worked as medicine, figuring out mass production, and creating a market to support that production. Oxford scientists Howard Florey and Ernst Chain rediscovered Fleming's neglected 1929 paper and saw potential where Fleming had faltered. Their colleague Norman Heatley engineered an ingenious contraption from spare parts that could transform 12 liters of moldy broth into 2 liters of functional penicillin in just an hour. After successful mouse experiments, the Oxford team sought a human test subject. They found Albert Alexander, a policeman who had scratched his face on a rose thorn while gardening. The minor wound had become catastrophically infected. On February 12, 1941, Alexander received his first dose of penicillin. The results were astonishing. Within hours, his fever normalized, his remaining eye cleared, and the pus disappeared completely. Yet triumph turned to tragedy when their limited penicillin supply ran out after 2 weeks. His infection returned, and on March 15th, he died, killed by a simple rose thorn scratch. To solve the production problem, Florey turned to America. The U.S. military, recognizing penicillin's potential to save troops from infection, quickly backed the project. Drug companies like Merck and Pfizer joined the effort. In Peoria, bacteriologist Mary Hunt, nicknamed Moldy Mary, examined rotting produce in grocery stores. Her discovery of a particularly productive mold in a cantaloupe revolutionized production. Nearly every strain of penicillin used today descends from Hunt's find. By D-Day in June 1944, American drug companies were mass-producing stable penicillin for military hospitals worldwide. Allied troops carried it alongside their weapons onto Normandy's beaches. Penicillin's development from Fleming's 1928 observation to mass deployment by 1944 transformed medicine forever. The miracle drug and its successors saved hundreds of millions, if not billions, of lives. Tuberculosis fell from America's 3rd most common cause of death to not even ranking in the top 50. In 1869, Irish scientist Mary Ward was killed when thrown from an experimental steam-powered vehicle traveling under 4 miles per hour. Though remembered for her achievements in astronomy and microscopy, Ward's death marked the beginning of a new category of human mortality. As the industrial age progressed, machine-related accidents introduced unprecedented forms of violent death previously seen only on battlefields. No machine would rival the automobile's death toll. In just over a century, more than 4 million Americans have died in car accidents, 3 times the number killed in all American military conflicts combined. The automobile's impact on life expectancy was particularly severe because it claimed so many young lives, including celebrities like James Dean, Albert Camus, and the fathers of 2 future presidents. In 1955, cars like the best-selling Chevrolet Bel Air had virtually no safety features, no seat belts, headrests, rearview mirrors, dashboard padding, or airbags. Despite growing fatalities, the automobile industry largely dismissed the problem as inevitable physics. Human bodies were simply too fragile for high-speed collisions. The breakthrough needed wasn't mechanical, but conceptual. Someone needed to believe the problem could actually be solved. Hugh DeHaven's near-fatal 1917 airplane crash sparked his revolutionary insight about vehicle safety. While others might have seen divine intervention in his survival, DeHaven recognized a fundamental truth. How a vehicle's structure packages its occupants dramatically affects crash outcomes. He transformed his kitchen into a crash laboratory, dropping eggs from heights onto foam to test impact absorption. His work founded the field of injury science with its radical premise: crashes and injuries weren't inevitable, but predictable and preventable. Colonel John Stapp's extreme deceleration tests proved a crucial point. If someone could survive stopping from 600 miles per hour in seconds, surely automobile crashes at 60 miles per hour could be survivable. Stapp advised Ford on their 1956 lifeguard safety package, which featured safety door latches, lap belts, padded dashboards, and recessed steering wheels. But when General Motors threatened legal action and consumers showed little interest, a new consensus emerged: safety didn't sell. The true breakthrough in auto safety came from Sweden, where Volvo hired aeronautical engineer Nils Bohlin. Bohlin developed the 3-point seatbelt, a design that absorbed G-forces on both chest and pelvis while remaining simple enough for a child to use. By 1959, Volvo made the 3-point belt standard. Recognizing its humanitarian value, Volvo chose not to enforce Bohlin's patent, making it freely available to all manufacturers. The impact has been staggering, over 1 million lives saved. Despite clear evidence of seatbelts' effectiveness, American automakers resisted safety innovations until lawyer Ralph Nader published his 1965 bestseller, Unsafe at Any Speed. In September 1966, Congress passed the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act, requiring seatbelts in all new cars sold in America. The cumulative impact has been extraordinary. Drivers today are 10 times less likely to die than in the early automotive era. Recent innovations point toward an even more radical possibility: self-driving cars that avoid accidents altogether. For millennia, mass famines have been an almost unavoidable feature of agricultural societies. The Irish potato famine killed 1/8 of Ireland's population in the 1840s. Climate shifts in the 1300s triggered famines killing perhaps 1/3 of Northern Europe's population. Even when not causing mass death, chronic food shortages extract subtle costs. Robert Fogel observed that 18th and early 19th century European diets resembled those in chronically malnourished 1970s Rwanda or India. These limited diets capped labor productivity. British agriculture couldn't provide enough calories for more than 80% of potential workers to sustain regular manual labor. Despite height increases suggesting improved nutrition, agricultural advances weren't sufficient to eliminate mass starvation in Europe until recently. Famines triggered the French Revolution, killed hundreds of thousands in Scandinavia in the late 1800s, and claimed over a million lives during the Irish potato famine. Globally, starvation continued depressing life expectancy until the 1970s. Then, almost overnight, famine's ancient stranglehold loosened. Deaths plummeted from 50 million between 1940-1980 to just 5 million from 1980 to present, a drop from 82 per 100,000 people to merely 0.5 per 100,000. This transformation came through the Haber-Bosch process for synthesizing ammonium nitrate from air and heat with an iron catalyst. While this artificial nitrogen fixation likely caused hundreds of thousands of additional war deaths by enabling explosives production, it also revolutionized agriculture by freeing farmers from dependence on naturally fertile soil. Without this process and subsequent green revolution, more than half of Earth's ice-free land would need cultivation to support today's population. The 20th century's battle against hunger extended beyond soil to controversial factory farming of livestock. In 1923, Delaware farmer Cecile Steele received 500 chicks instead of her usual 50 due to a hatchery typo. Rather than returning them, she housed them in a piano box, fattened them with new feed supplements, and sold 387 2-pound birds for profit. Within 5 years, she'd built one of the first factory chicken farms. By the 1950s, vitamin D and antibiotic supplements allowed chickens to live indoors without sunlight. The efficiency was remarkable. Producing a pound of chicken required just 2 pounds of grain versus 7 pounds for beef. Today, Americans consume over 90 pounds of chicken annually. Global production has exploded. Brazil increased from 217 to 13,000 metric tons since 1970, while China and India grew tenfold in just two decades. The scale is staggering. 23 billion chickens exist at any moment, with humans consuming 60 billion annually, more than all other bird species combined. These agricultural revolutions doubled Earth's carrying capacity. Without these breakthroughs, half of today's 7.7 billion people would never have existed or would have starved. Chronic undernourishment in developing countries dropped from over one-third 50 years ago to just over 10% today. However, these advances came with significant costs. Artificial fertilizer production consumes 5% of global natural gas, while runoff creates massive marine dead zones. The unprecedented population of 23 billion chickens creates perfect conditions for breeding new avian flu strains. Our environmental challenges stem not just from industrialization, but from our success in preventing famine and starvation. Most encouraging is how the gap between Western nations and the global South has narrowed dramatically in recent decades. Sweden took 150 years to reduce childhood mortality from 30% to under 1%, while South Korea accomplished this in just 45 years. India's life expectancy has risen from 35 after World War II to over 70 today. China has closed its life expectancy gap with the U.S. from 20 years in 1951 to just 4 years now. Looking at our pantheon of life-saving innovations reveals a striking pattern. Most breakthroughs originated outside the private sector. From antibiotics to vaccines to chlorination, the majority emerged from academic research, enterprising doctors, or field workers creating solutions during crises. Beyond tangible innovations lie equally important conceptual breakthroughs. Ways of seeing, ways of counting, ways of testing, ways of connecting, ways of discovering, and ways of amplifying. What innovations will shape the next chapter of human life expectancy? In low-income countries, waterborne diseases remain the second leading cause of death. The Gates Foundation's off-grid toilet prototype offers hope, a closed-loop system that burns waste as fuel and disinfects water for just 5 cents per day. Malaria eradication represents another frontier, with scientists exploring gene drive technology to either reduce mosquito populations or make mosquitoes resistant to the Plasmodium parasite. The most promising meta-innovations may be new approaches to data gathering and analysis. Sentinel surveillance captures data earlier in the epidemic timeline than traditional methods. Kinza's internet-connected thermometers anonymously transmit geolocated temperature readings, creating health weather maps that track atypical fevers down to county level. The most radical approach eliminates humans entirely through animal surveillance to catch zoonotic diseases before they jump to humans. Computer gaming may transform 21st century longevity. Google's DeepMind subsidiary developed algorithms that explore novel compounds that could destroy viruses, halt cancer growth, or repair damaged neurons. Rather than searching for microbes in soil samples, these systems can explore billions of combinations of amino acids to create protein structures that might outfox pathogens. Some researchers challenge our acceptance that life must end, suggesting aging itself could be removed from the catalog of evils. Scientists now believe aging results from specific epigenetic instructions rather than inevitable wear and tear. Stanford's Howard Chang discovered that the protein NFKB triggers aging in skin cells. Inhibiting it made older mice's skin look younger. Japanese biologist Shinya Yamanaka identified four genes responsible for resetting the aging clock. Building on this, Juan Carlos Ispisua Belmonte engineered mice with these Yamanaka factors that activated only when the mice drank a specific drug twice weekly. These mice lived 30% longer than controls, not by fighting disease, but by slowing aging itself. Ending aging would fundamentally transform humanity. It would strain Earth's carrying capacity, challenge religious precepts, and introduce new inequalities. Yet it would also eliminate the suffering of aging and grief of losing loved ones. If resetting cellular clocks becomes possible, shouldn't we collectively decide whether to take this momentous step? We may need new global regulatory institutions to help navigate such complex choices. The Dixon Mounds in Illinois remind us that progress isn't inevitable. When these Native Americans adopted agriculture around 1150 AD, skeletal evidence shows life expectancy plummeted from 26 to 19 years. Childhood mortality exceeded 50%, and only 5% survived to 50. Societies have made choices that shortened rather than extended lives, creating downward spirals lasting millennia. The greatest threat to our 20,000 days of extra life may paradoxically come from that very triumph. If life expectancy declines in the next century, the most likely culprit will be the environmental impact of billions living in industrialized societies. Bola Island embodies both our greatest public health triumph and our potential future crisis. Four decades ago, it witnessed humanity's extraordinary achievement in eliminating smallpox. Yet today, large stretches of the island have been permanently lost to rising seawaters caused by global warming. The entire island may disappear by 2079, when our descendants celebrate the centennial of smallpox eradication. Will smallpox be just the first in a long line of threats removed from the catalog of evils? Or will those momentous achievements, all that unexpected life, be washed away by an actual tide?